How many times have our patients returned to our office and are just stuck in the cycle of chronic inflammation? We throw everything we have at them, nothing changes, and even our dentists are frustrated. Rather than throwing our hands up and shrugging, we need to be turning to PerioTrace by PerioProtect. I have seen the evidence firsthand and have helped so many hygienists find this resource because it really works, which is why there are so many products on the market now trying to imitate them. The results are speaking for themselves, but rather than going with an unproven product, stick with the only periodontal medicine delivery system cleared by the FDA. And not only that, but their support team is seriously among the best I've ever encountered, from the education to implementation to support when there's the inevitable bumps on the road. They are there for you. If you want to get in contact with them to learn more about how you can treat your patients better, head over to perioprotect.com/RDH. And on that site, at the bottom is a contact form that you can fill out or simply email them directly to ask for help. This is one thing I truly believe should be in every dental practice. perioprotect.com/RDH to stop the cycle of chronic inflammation.
If you're somebody who has poor oral health, that might be a good predictor to poor gut health as well. You guys are a really good first line defense in this. So it may seem silly, but it's kind of a good indicator to like just where our healthcare is going and being more of a collaboration than everybody is individualized. IBD in general tend to, number one, undergo more dental procedures than the regular patient, than the average patient. And then number two, tend to have more dental caries in both the incisors or canines.
Get ready for your unofficial dental hygiene podcast. These are the tales of two hygienists, one East Coast RDH and one West Coast Guygenist. Listen as they tackle the profession of dental hygiene with humor and enthusiasm. Now, please join Michelle Strange and Andrew Johnston as they tell you a tale of two hygienists.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of A Tale of Two Hygienists, episode number 305. My name is Andrew.
And this is Michelle, and welcome to the podcast. We're excited that you're here. And this is a dental-focused podcast, but we have another medical provider on. And these are the episodes that make my heart skip a beat. It makes me so happy.
You couldn't come up with an analogy that has to do with the topic, though? Like, the heart's not close enough to Crohn's disease.
This episode makes my guts bubble. No.
See, that's what I'm talking about. I knew you could bring it. Good job.
I don't know. That's a horrible one. That actually makes me feel like I would be ill. But I know. Yes, we are talking gut health and Crohn's and inflammatory bowel diseases. And I'm really excited. And Andrew, I just want to say I brought yet another TikToker on. That's amazing.
Yeah. Look, I'm actually really surprised by the – well, I guess I can't be surprised by the actual individuals that you're following on TikTok, because I think that you do a pretty good job of like weeding out the noise. But I'm always surprised by the level of content. Like, these are people that would be having their own podcasts like we do, that bring it in their industry the way that we try and bring it in our industry. And so, yeah, yes, kudos to you. Pat on the back. There you go.
Yeah, thank you. That's all I'm asking for. Because I understand when I tell people, like, yeah, I brought another TikToker on. Because, I mean, it's like, it's a dancing app. I'm like, haven't we all moved past that it is not? I mean, it's trash.
What did you just say? Before this show, you just said, well, I can't dance as good as them. You said that. Those are your words.
I did. It started out as that. Okay. And there is a dance talk, but there are so many algorithms now. There's something called clean talk where you can learn all the cleaning tips. I get pushed over there occasionally and I'm like, well, I don't have like a house I care to clean that deep because I'm in an Airbnb all the time. But if I did, this would be amazing. I'm sure there's a dental talk over there. I'm just not on that side of it.
Surprising. Yeah,
it is.
I still think the app is garbage, but I'm glad that you are able to find the diamonds in the rough.
Yes, I will say that. I have found the diamonds in the rough. It's pretty great. But yeah, this was a really great episode. I so enjoyed learning from Jennifer, and I don't know, the gut, ever since my, well, I've always had this gut issue, right? Like, because I was born with a busted abdomen, no mesentery, so silly. And now that I'm going through all of the ways to get healthy again, I just have so much, I don't know, sympathy and empathy for people who struggle with like any kind of bowel disease. I mean, that is, it's tough.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
It's tough.
You know, and this was, it was so informative. This is one of the ones that I hated having to be silent on. And that was mostly not because you guys wouldn't let me talk, but because, you know, computer issues, it's in this weird hotel room. Anyway, the whole thing, but like there was so much good quality conversation that I think that we could even have her on again. There's so much to learn.
Yeah. And what was really great is that she was listening to us too, like taking in some of our feedback as dental hygienist. And like, I mean, chef's kiss, right? Like that's what we want. Like we want to be able to have this bi-directional exchange of information that helps us better understand our how to treat a patient holistically, where we don't silo body parts and body systems to a point where we were like, we forget that they function in one human, you know?
Right.
It's crazy. I will say on another note that, you know, I am in New Orleans and they hate the gluten-free here. I'm just here to say it to you guys. They hate the gluten-free.
Yeah.
Everything else about this city, loving it. I mean, it's a little dysfunctional. The politics is a little meh, but food is amazing, I'm told, because I can't eat anything.
Okay.
It's so sad to be a vegan, gluten-free vegan is, it's a rough life out here for the gluten-free vegans. Oh my God. So don't go to New Orleans if you're gluten-free, or just get comfortable with them offering you oatmeal and that's all they have. Yeah, that's my advice. Anything else you want to chat about?
No, I can't wait to get into this episode though. You guys are going to really enjoy it.
All right, well, enjoy this episode with Jennifer Fior.
Before we get to the interview, we want to say a big thank you to Paradise Dental Technologies, or PDT, for supporting the continuing education portion of this podcast for so many years. If you do not know already, many of our full-length episodes count for CE. You'll find the links in the show notes, or you can sign up for our newsletter by going to ataleoftwohygienists.com. When you sign up for the newsletter, we will periodically send out links to shows that have expiring CE courses attached. And none of this could be possible without the support of the amazing people over at PDT. So check out their hygiene and other instruments at pdtdental.com. That's pdtdental.com. Now, on to the interview.
Well, listeners, welcome to another podcast interview. And I'm really excited when we can bring on the non-dental people and our fellow healthcare providers that we love to collaborate with. And so today we are going to be talking about some gut things like Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. And I'm really, really excited to finally have this conversation on this podcast. And we have Jennifer Fior on. Jennifer, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. So Jennifer, tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do, and why you are so, the expert in this gut health world.
Well, that's a loaded question. yeah. I guess, yeah, I can start with my background. I'm a nurse practitioner. I am trained as a family nurse practitioner, but I have gravitated towards the GI system since I was kind of a younger lass. I accidentally fell into it because I was actually doing oral health before. I was an oral surgeon assistant. And
I didn't know this about you, Jennifer.
Actually, my mom used to work at a dental office, and then I went into oral surgery for my first job out of college because I have a background in biology, and my friend had gotten me a job in, you know, healthcare adjacent. I wanted anything that was healthcare to see where to start, and so that's where I started. But, you know, I realized that the mouth wasn't the only thing I wanted to focus on. So I fell into a job doing GI as an assistant. And from there, I kind of parlayed that into a nurse. And then I went back, got my nurse practitioner license, and just kind of stuck with GI. So I have been gut deep for a long time, just doing kind of here, there, and everywhere. I was at University of Chicago. I worked with Northwestern, and then I needed a change and decided to come to the Pacific Northwest. So I've been out here since doing that. And I've been a GI nurse practitioner for about 5, maybe 6 years. You lose track with COVID these days. And it's been great. I love where I work. I do general GI in an outpatient setting. And, you know, I get to see a little bit of everything. And I think that's why I enjoy it so much. It is a little bit of here, there, and everywhere. Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis does play a portion. Whether, you know, it's a small or large portion kind of depends on where you are. But I do have patients who experience inflammatory bowel disease, and I treat them as well. And this is kind of a huge chunk of it that not a lot of people focus on, which is why I'm excited to be here today, is to kind of gear towards the oral health, because we do a lot of focusing on the medication management and the disease process by itself. But there are kind of some hidden things that people don't really look for or know about, that, you know, you guys can be obviously the first line defense in detecting some of this stuff. So that's why I'm really excited to come here today and talk about all of this.
Same, same. I love collaborating with other medical providers. And I love that I got your name from Tyler, also known as That Sassy MP, who has been on the podcast before.
Love Sassy.
And I was like, do you know anyone? I want to really talk about this, because I do feel there's something out there that I don't know, that I could be looking for. I could be acknowledging with my patients. I could be bringing it to their attention, or I could know this at that might be their struggle and kind of, I don't know, look for the other oral health alternatives and stuff out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I would love just to kind of get started with, what are these diseases or these issues that are afflicting our patients? What make them different? What make them similar? And what are some of the symptoms that our patients are struggling with?
Sure. So if we're going to focus on inflammatory bowel disease, what we're talking about is an autoimmune condition that increases inflammation of the intestines. It's kind of a broad name for both ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. They present somewhat similarly, but they are different in certain aspects. The difference between ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease mainly is where it is affected inside the intestines. So, for example, ulcerative colitis, colon means the col of the portion means the colon, and itis means inflammation. So it's inflammation of the colon. Usually when we see patients with inflammation of the colon, it starts from the bottom and progresses towards the top. It's usually in a continuous fashion. So when we're looking at the colon, the inflammation starts from the bottom and proceeds upwards. It can affect portions of the colon or the entire colon. It depends on where we see it inside the colon, what we kind of name it. So if it's throughout the entire colon, we call it pancolitis. If it's just the bottom portion, we call it proctitis. Otherwise, you can also see left-sided colitis, which means it involves the entire left side of the colon. On the other hand, Crohn's disease is similar in that they basically both have inflammation, but where Crohn's disease will pop up is anywhere from mouth to anus. So your patients that you see may have more oral lesions and things to look out for in Crohn's disease than ulcerative colitis, but that's not exclusive with just Crohn's disease. So patients will have inflammation or irritation in their upper GI tract, small bowel, and colon as well. And this one is kind of what we call skipped lesions or patches that can occur throughout the entire intestine. And so when you see these presentations, they will oftentimes come from a GI perspective very similarly, with symptoms of abdominal pain. Some can have bloody diarrhea. Sometimes they don't have to have diarrhea depending on where things are, but you can also have unintentional weight loss. So losing weight without trying is another issue. And that's secondary to sometimes malabsorption of nutrients in the small intestine. So due to the inflammation, they're not absorbing everything properly. You'll see vitamin and mineral deficiencies, which can also present in oral terms as well. So these are some things that you guys can look out for with malnutrition as a possibility as well. So going back to with Crohn's disease, I'll start from there. with Crohn's disease, because it affects the small bowel, there may be some malabsorption. For example, iron, vitamins and minerals may be malabsorbed. So you may see some vitamin and mineral deficiencies as well as weight loss.
That's interesting, because I do have a, well, I did once upon a lifetime have a patient that just could not make it to their appointment. Like they were struggling. So all of those symptoms, I'm like, yeah, I bet you were. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Here. And I wouldn't want to leave my house either if I was struggling.
It's tough. They can go to the bathroom anywhere from, you know, like a couple times a day up to 20 times or more with the diarrhea. And until the inflammation is under control, a lot of them really struggle with significant pain and just urgent diarrhea. And we're talking even nighttime symptoms, getting woken up in the middle of the night. So sleep can be interrupted. And then, of course, that kind of throws everything off for a person. So it can be really life-altering, especially when you're struggling to get things under control.
I'm curious about diets for anybody with inflammatory bowel disease. Do they tend to lean more towards like carb heavy or softer diets? Like what's a diet look like?
Or so that's actually a great question. There's like a lot of research that's currently being done on this. And a lot of people think, oh, carbs will probably help. And in some cases they do. They temporarily do. In an active flare, that's when people are experiencing the, you know, abdominal pain, bloody diarrheas multiple times per day. That's what we consider a flare, when there's active inflammation. And in that setting, sometimes a low fiber or what we call a low residue diet, so those very easy to eat things, may feel better in that period of time. But statistically, they do worse on these, you know, meat-heavy, high-fat, high-carb diets. And in fact, the studies that have been coming out and the data that's been researched is actually showing more towards Mediterranean diets. They've also done some studies on FODMAP diets that kind of overlaps with irritable bowel syndrome. And then there's a particular diet called the specific carbohydrate diet, where you're taking out specific refined sugars and certain types of foods that actually limits what they call pro-inflammatory type foods. So essentially, you're kind of limiting that exposure to the foods that may cause more irritation or acute inflammation. And preceding even a diagnosis, there have been studies that show high sugar or high fat and processed meats like red meats can lead towards inflammatory bowel disease. So there's a couple of interesting studies that have shown that patients who have like really high sugar or processed food diets tend to do worse and actually can be more predisposed to developing irritable bowel syndrome. And then likewise, you'll see it often, patients will be like, I just ate like junk and I went into a flare. And so they come in with these symptoms after eating junk food essentially or fast food. And then we have to kind of get them back under control. So diet does play a role very specifically in IBD, but it's not the only thing that obviously is involved. And right now they're talking about using diets in adjunct to medication treatment because it does play a huge impact. In children, they may even use it alone, but theoretically for adults, it hasn't been as significant in putting people into remission, and that's kind of the important part. And I can talk a little bit more about remission if you want to know what that looks like.
Yeah, I think where my little brain is kind of like spinning in the oral health world, you know, we talk a lot about nutritional counseling with our patients because we know that there are certain foods, there's certain frequency of intake, there's all kinds of things that will drop or lower the pH in the mouth, and an acid attack is usually very indicative. Caries will follow very quickly.
Yes.
We know people are struggling with, you know, decay rates when they don't have a healthy diet. So it's just really interesting. That's kind of where my head is spinning.
Yeah.
Like, okay, we not only, well, and we know them, you know, like you said, from anus to mouth. Like, that is the digestive tract. And these are the things that we have to be concerned about. What's going to affect the mouth is probably going to affect the gut.
You're right. Yeah, actually, there's been more research that's being done to say, does your mouth, does your oral health predict your outcome of IBD? Because, you know, if you think about it, gut bacteria starts in the mouth. So if you're like with eating different fruits, vegetables, whole grains, those promote good gut bacteria. The poor or dysbiosis, the bad gut bacteria, can oftentimes come about with these types of diets. So if you're in basically eating all of the junk stuff, you're already kind of setting yourself up with that bad gut bacteria. But of course, keep in mind what's going in, you know, your teeth and the bacteria in your mouth can impact what's going on in your gut too through translocation. So sometimes if you're somebody who has poor oral health, that might be a good predictor to poor gut health as well.
That's, I've often wondered that, especially, and this is completely clinical observation, anecdotal clinician, nothing that I've found that to support it, but I often, I worked a lot in perio, in periodontics, people who struggle with their periodontal disease. And there were so many times that I just could not get them healthy. They could have great oral health. And I mean, I know so much more now. We know more about the oral systemic link. We know about like C-reactive proteins. We know all kinds of things now that we are being more mindful of. And But I often wondered if there was this gut connection and if they were truly inflamed in their gut health, could I actually get their oral health under control?
That's a great question, because the rates out there show that patients who have IBD, inflammation in their gut, actually have higher risk of periodontitis. Is that correct how to say it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Actually do. And there's a certain risk of dental caries that occur in patients who also have IBD. And it's just, is there active inflammation in the mouth as well as the gut? You might be right. So that can sometimes be, I wouldn't say a definite like correlation. If you have periodontitis, you definitely have IBD, but could there be some overlap in that? Absolutely. I absolutely think so.
And so I would love to chat a little bit more about oral lesions. How do you feel about kind of walking us through maybe even the pathophysiology of what's happening? I mean, because is that, if so, let's say somebody has an ulcerative lesion in their mouth, is that very similar to what's happening in their gut?
So when you look at inflammatory bowel disease, the biggest thing that comes about that we know about are like aphthous ulcers, because you can have ulcerations throughout the entire oral tract to the anal tract with especially Crohn's disease. So you'll see that usually it's more in children than adults, oddly enough, but you'll still see some oral lesions like aphthous ulcers on the lips. You can have, in the buccal mucosa or like the gingiva, you'll see that as well. And then there's also what we see inside the colon on occasion is cobblestoning effect of the intestines, but that can appear in the mouth as well. So you can kind of see some cobblestoning in the mouth. It's kind of on the side of the buccal area,
in the cheek area or the vestibule.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So you'll kind of see what looks like when I say cobblestoning, like a cobblestone road, how they have that like big, like these large stones overlapping. That's kind of what it almost looks like in the mouth and then sometimes on the in the intestines.
That sounds painful. Is it painful? Because I know I have some people that have lichen planus, don't even know they got it. And then I have some that have it and it's like they brush their teeth and it's like knives through their tissue. So is the cobblestoning often painful?
You know, and I don't really know the answer to that. I can't imagine it feeling good because it's edematous. So it's like swollen. And I don't know if you've ever bitten your cheek and then accidentally continued to bite your cheek. I can only imagine that that's not comfortable. So I can't even imagine what the cobblestoning would feel like in that scenario.
And I would also, my thought process goes to, I wonder if there are certain medicaments that are better or worse for an outbreak like that, or somebody in a constant level of inflammation is there? Because we know things like SLS in toothpaste cause people to have more ulcerative lesions in their mouth. So when we remove that, I don't know, my mind's like, okay, what products could I still be recommending?
Well, and I think the hard part is the underlying issue is an autoimmune reaction and IBD. So really treating the underlying issue, suppressing the immune system is going to help with some of those. But you can always do things to help with like the discomfort of stomatitis or the aphthous ulcers. They have the magic mouthwash that can just kind of numb things. And it's really just a Band-Aid. It's not the actual end-all be-all to treating that stuff. Treating is really treating the underlying condition. So putting the IBD into remission. And oftentimes that requires time and different medication trials. Mm. And then, of course, with the medications comes issues too. Yeah.
And then there comes the dry mouth. And then there comes the...
Well, you can, and then you're immunosuppressed. So could you have then thrush that comes with that? That's always another thing too. Yeah.
My mind is spinning out a little bit now too, because I'm like, oh, there's so many layers to this.
There are so many layers. That's why I'm saying like it would be so easy for me to say like, here are what you would see. But like there are rarities that can also happen that, you know, with just oral lesions, fistulas can occur, abscesses can occur, especially in Crohn's disease. It's really rare, but you can fistulize an abscess anywhere. So if there's, let's say, an abscess inside the mouth, that could come out through and you can see a draining lesion inside the mouth. It's really rare that it would come out from the face, but that can happen the same way it can happen rectally too. So there's just very rare things that can happen that also kind of blow your mind.
That is interesting. So the abscess isn't tooth related. It's not necrotic nerve or a periodontal abscess. It's more one that stems from the inflammation.
It would be rare, but it would be those are, I've never personally see one. I've read about oral abscesses that can cause fistulas. That would be like a really rare thing though.
Wow. But that's still something that we see should be mindful of.
Yeah, we see them rectally. So it would make sense with that, that it could possibly also happen the other way. Hmm.
And so if you could, what is the treatment? I know you said some medicine and some other things, but like, what is going to be the journey for our patients that are, that have found out that they have, you know, irritable bowel disease, and what, I'm sure it's different for Crohn's and ulcerative.
So I'm going to correct you. It's inflammatory bowel disease. Irritable bowel syndrome sounds and presents very similar, but it's a completely different, it's a horse of a different color.
Thank you for that correction.
No, you're welcome. It's a common thing. And it, you know, they're both said so frequently and interchangeably that it definitely can be confusing, but they are completely different disease processes. But you're right. What can happen? What to expect? So when a person is initially diagnosed with IBD, whether it be Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, usually we'll start them on a treatment. Depending on the location, the amount of involvement in the intestines, we may treat differently. If it's ulcerative colitis and it's very small and just a short lesion in their intestines, sometimes we'll do topical treatment. So it's like doing an oral, if you had something in your mouth, doing like an oral swish. It's kind of the same thing with an enema or a suppository. They can also take oral medications called mesalamines or azathioprines, immunosuppressants. And then as things kind of progress or the more that's involved, we may go to a biologic agent. Biologic agents are basically infusions, some are injections, and these are putting the inflammation into remission. Steroids are sometimes used, but we really try to stay away from steroids. I'm sure you're aware that there's many long-term side effects to steroids. So the idea of steroids is a short bridge to get you through this flare until your other medication puts you into remission. So we really, truly do try to stay away from steroids as much as possible. And some of this, you know, some of this is difficult to treat because you're kind of suffering through it. And sometimes things don't work. We have to switch to a different agent. We have to escalate the treatment. So, you know, meanwhile, you're still suffering through all of this. So it can be very difficult. And like I said before, life altering and, you know, life changing for people. You're committed to something for indefinitely. It's a chronic progressive disease. Some people can get into remission and stay in remission. Occasionally you can fall out of remission. So, you know, it is something that people do have to deal with lifelong and be vigilant of.
I'm wondering, like, if there is there anything that we could be recommending? The first thing that comes to mind is xylitol to help manage decay and pH control that would also be an issue for gut.
You know, I'm not sure if that obviously dental caries and, you know, good oral health in general probably wouldn't hurt to kind of improve gut health. But you had mentioned before the diet stuff that can be helpful. I would also say smoking cessation is another one. You know, alcohol and tobacco can cause a lot of different GI issues. Smoking by itself can actually increase the likelihood. I will say that with smoking, it's funny because in ulcerative colitis, it does tend to improve the symptoms. I kind of get confused on this one. I think it's ulcerative colitis does tend to get improved with smoking. However, the outcomes are worse overall. It leads to a longer disease process. So we do recommend quitting smoking. I'm not endorsing smoking at all for ulcerative colitis, yeah. But we tend to see that when people do quit, that's when they tend to flare. But they've noted that, you know, with the overall health, you're just worse off with the smoking, especially since you already have an increased risk for cancers. That kind of further increases that risk. It's not recommended, but that would be another thing. And then I've also read poor fitting dentures can also kind of contribute to some of the oral issues with UC and I'm sorry, IBD. So that's another thing. If you see, you know,
that makes
young
sense
patients.
To me.
Yeah. If you see young patients, especially with these oral lesions, I mean, I would implore them to refer to like the GPs so that they can get checked out because they're the ones who are typically going to come first with these abnormal lesions and kind of present a little bit atypically than the adult cohort, which will be primarily the diarrhea, abdominal pain, bloody stools, mucus in the stools, etc. Kids tend to present a little bit differently. And I'm not a pediatric specialist, but I do know that they have a higher tendency of oral lesions.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, you guys also have the opportunity to be first line to see you on at least annual, if twice a year. So you guys get to see them a lot more than even their general physician tends to see them sometimes. So it's a good opportunity, you know, to kind of do some diet education, like I was saying, the sugary things or the processed things, and then kind of making sure that you're the first line defense if you see any oral lesions, especially the, the angular chelitis?
Chelitis.
Yeah, that's a big one too. I forgot to mention that earlier.
Hmm. Is that because of the like a B deficiency or malnutrition?
Sometimes, yep. You can have the vitamin deficiencies and you'll see it right there with the malabsorption of folate or vitamin B, where especially because Crohn's disease tends to pop up in the terminal ileum and that's where it's absorbed. So you'll see them with a vitamin deficiency because of that, and they'll kind of present with the little cracks on the side of their mouths.
Mm. Which, I mean, some of us might just be like, oh, it's winter, chapped lips.
True. But if you see them again in 6 months and they still have that, that's a perfect opportunity to say something in their chart like, hey, I saw this last time and now I see it again and it hasn't gone away. Either you're a kid with really trapped lips and your mom needs to get some Blistex or we got something else going on here.
Yeah. So if I could play this out just for a second, like if I have a and I don't do peds, either. Andrew loves the peds. I run from the peds. But they occasionally somehow make their way on my schedule. And so if I were to see a child and I noticed the maybe some slight angular cheilitis, like more chapness, maybe an ulcer or something, nothing crazy. What would the conversation with the parent look like? Could I bring up, like, you know, if these don't resolve in X amount of time, do you notice any issues when they eat certain foods? Like, well, is there something that I can bring up and bring awareness to?
I think that's a really good point. You know, you can always say, you know, say, hey, this is not a normal finding. It could be related to something completely benign, but it could also be an indicator to something else that might be going on. And, you know, I don't know how comfortable you are with your patients, but if you're seeing them on a routinely basis, you might have a really good relationship with them. So bringing this up to the parents and saying, you know, this could be signs of, you know, possible malabsorption or not a deficiency in something. I don't know if it's due to not getting enough or if they're just not absorbing it properly. Are they having any other issues? Is there anything in particular that you've noticed that they haven't been gaining weight or, you know, they tend to eat a lot and not really go anywhere with their weight? They've been losing weight or they've had bowel issues at all? And that can be just an easy two questions. Are they gaining weight? Are they having bowel issues? And that's a pretty good way to get the conversation rolling. And if the answers to those are yes, then, you know, I would have them see their pediatrician or even for an adult, see their GP just to start the conversation. If not, you've now placed this in their head and now they'll be kind of looking for stuff. So even if, you know, they haven't really noticed anything, now they'll kind of look out for it and say, oh, hey, he did tell me that he had some diarrhea a lot, and I didn't even think about that. I just chalked it up to him not liking milk or not wanting to eat dinner or something, you know? So at least you're kind of planting that seed for something to kind of be aware of. And I think that's kind of the biggest thing is getting, like, that's the whole point of this podcast is to get this out there and to get people to begin to become aware of what to look out for.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Absolutely. And I mean, I also, my mind is like, oh, our medical history needs to be so much longer. Like, you know, asking about weight changes, you know, that, but I don't, in our field, we have a hard time with people being like, what am I doing? This is just dinner. This is just a cleaning.
And I'm I know. Now but you guys, again, you guys have like, I mean, I've heard so many people tell me like how they've had their hypertension diagnosed at the dental office. I can't tell you how many times I've had people tell me that they have GERD because of their dental appointments. And, you know, that's a huge one. I hear that all the time. Like these patients who've had silent GERD and, you know, I've talked to them about atypical symptoms as well. And it turns out that they didn't know that their, you know, chronic cough or frequent clearing of their throat was actually acid reflux this whole time. So you guys are a really good first line defense in this. So it may seem silly, but it's kind of a good indicator to like where our healthcare is going and being more of a collaboration than everybody is individualized.
Absolutely. And I think, I'm sure anybody who's listening to a dental hygiene podcast, I think is pretty much on the elite engaged side of patient care. So I'm sure they're already having these conversations and everything. But if anybody's just tuning in and you hear this, like, I hope you hear how important you are as a clinician and that you aren't just teeth cleaners. You're not tooth scrapers. Like, you are a part of the medical team because we can find all these things. And, you know, the GERD part I find interesting because I had – when I was told about that chronic cough or the constant clearing of the throat as a potential symptom, it was like I couldn't unsee it. And so many of my older male patients, they, as soon as they leaned back, it was just a constant. And I was like,
yeah,
let's
exactly
talk about this.
And that's all you hear in your mind the rest of the appointment. You're like, GERD, GERD.
Yeah, exactly.
I know. I experience the same thing in the office, especially when they come in for symptoms. I'll be like, do you do that a lot? But they're like, what? I'm like, now you're going to do it for the rest of the office appointment. But do you clear your throat a lot? I do clear my throat a lot constantly. People tell me that all the time. And I'm like, yep. Yep, there it is. So, I mean, and you know, like I said, it's a very benign thing that nobody would think twice about. But once you start kind of fitting these patterns in your head, you become kind of not, I wouldn't say a detective, but you guys are at least the first people that can start to put the pieces of the puzzle together for people.
I'm just curious, like, I know this is an autoimmune disease. Is there any understanding of like, why
sets it
where
up? Yeah.
It starts, what's the catalyst to the inflammation?
I am so glad you asked that.
Good.
So, you know, we know that there is a component that can be genetic. You have to have genes for this to turn on. As I had mentioned before, diet and lifestyle can definitely be, you know, something that can also play a part in this. The environment in general, you know, exposure to things like chemicals and such. In fact, there was one thing I read that inflammatory bowel disease in the United States was so rare before the Industrial Revolution. After the Industrial Revolution, it increased exponentially. Now, whether that's because we became more educated or if it was due to like exposure to different chemicals or, you know, newer things, I'm not sure, but there is definitely something to that. You know, the other stuff that can definitely play a part is, as we mentioned, oral health. They're now questioning if your oral health and bacteria translocation can play a part in it too. So you kind of have to have what's called a perfect storm for this to occur. It may also be bad luck too. I'm not sure. So some people will present in their early life. So you'll see children, teens to 20s is like that first peak. And then later in life, in like the 60s and 70s, you'll see another peak. So those are the two big, peak times that people will present. But I have also diagnosed people earlier, middle, later, et cetera. So it's not a one and done textbook presentation for everybody. But usually you'll see at certain points there'll be an increased risk of these. So age also plays a part in it too.
Mm. And is it more gender or sex-based?
You know, that's something I probably should know off the top of my head, but I don't.
I threw it at you. I am curious, like, as far as the conversation, I'm sure your conversations are filled with all kinds of education as far as their diet and stuff. Does oral health ever come up, and how does that conversation look, and do you ever get pushback?
I will be perfectly honest. Until you mentioned like this podcast to me, I thought, man, that is something I'm totally missing. Because I do, you know, and granted, I'm sure you know how this works. You kind of have a limited, finite amount of time to get of information in. But I tend to be, since I'm a nurse practitioner, I think I tend to be a little overzealous and lengthy with my office appointments because I do like to educate people. Because I'm kind of that kid who grew up with Schoolhouse Rock where like knowledge is power. So I tend to do a lot of educating during my office appointments. With certain inflammatory bowel disease, there are risks, you know, especially if you're on steroids, there are bone risks. So I always recommend, you know, DEXA scans for those who are at risk. I talk to them about annual exams, things that they should be getting annually. So like if there's a skin exam, if they're high risk for skin lesions or skin cancers, I'll oftentimes recommend that. Same thing with eye exams, especially those who have ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease can have also, you know, other things that can be manifested in the eyes. So I'll oftentimes recommend that. There's also, you know, cancer risks. So, you know, like for females, I recommend that they do their pap smears. And then, you know, depression is another thing that can be present. And that's kind of now becoming in the forefront. But I don't really remember us ever delving into the oral side of things. So it's actually really interesting that you bring this up, that I'm thinking this is a huge, huge thing that I could be missing. Like, you guys see them so often. So it's like I could easily input that into my health maintenance regimen, and I should, because it is another part of things. It's an uncomfortable part that people struggle through, and they just deal with it because they don't know that they can talk to people about this.
Yeah. And I this is where, gosh, I would just love to in my lifetime, in my career at all ever see the referral back and forth between specialty offices, general offices, physicians, and dental offices. Like, to be able to say, like, are you having lesions? I'm not going to check that. I have a dentist. If you don't already have a dental home, here you can go there. Like, gosh, right? What a dream. I dream so hard.
Maybe one day. Maybe one day. Yeah. I mean, it's starting. I think these things are starting. It's just not quite there yet. And I think the more that we put this information out there, the more it becomes, you know, unavoidable. So hopefully at some point it'll be very easy to just have, here's your team of care.
Oh, gosh, such a dream. So you just mentioned something about the vagus nerve. You mentioned about depression. So that triggered my thought process around the vagus nerve and that being so connected, you know, that brain-gut connection.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When somebody is suffering from IBD, like is there a vagus nerve? Does depression happen more? Because then I'm spinning out going, okay, patients that are depressed typically don't want to clean their mouth very much. They are going to bed earlier. They are falling asleep on the couch, or they are just very much unmotivated. And then that oral health trickle, like there's an issue with that.
There is a huge overlap of depression. And that is something that we definitely have not done a great job of addressing with our IBD patients. Or at least I know historically, I shouldn't say everybody, that's a really bad blanket statement. But it is something that kind of falls off the wayside, because what you're doing is you're like aiming towards the inflammation, the disease itself. And holistically, a lot of that stuff falls off the wayside. So you're right. With depression, it is very difficult to get up and brush your teeth, take a shower for some people. So could that also contribute? Absolutely. I'm sure it could. It's definitely something that could even, I mean, you guys could even screen for those sorts of things too, you know, as a component, I'm sure. It is a factor in IBD that, again, like I said, mental health has not been really addressed well over the history, but we're coming to find that should be something that is included in our health maintenance. And then, of course, we are seeing them probably more than their primary care doctors if they've been diagnosed with IBD. So we're probably the ones who are going to notice if they do start to fluctuate or, you know, seem to be more depressed. And I don't know if it's necessarily just because of the disease process or what kind of toll it takes on you emotionally, physically. So we tend to need to do better about not only identifying it, but then doing something about it, making referrals to people to address it.
Hmm. So, I mean, the vagus nerve and the depression that goes along with gut health to me is like a very personal, journey that I've had, where I had to have a cecum volvulus. And the depression that I got just from the vagus nerve and like just the trauma of the surgery and then being on a specialized diet out of nowhere, like not being able to go and, you know, feed myself in the same way. Yeah. I couldn't even order food because there wasn't very much that I could eat. And then the social side of it, like now my whole social life has changed because when I go, I can't have X, Y, and Z. So for me, I was like that. It's not just the trauma of the surgery or the trauma.
No, it's very isolating.
The vagus nerve.
Absolutely.
Yes. And it's a whole thing.
I think that's the toughest part of GI is like dealing with the mind-gut connection. And, you know, oftentimes patients who do have inflammatory bowel disease can also have overlapping IBS. And I'm not sure which came first, chicken or the egg. But, you know, oftentimes IBS can be made worse by worsening stress, anxiety, et cetera. So they'll come in, which they think is a flare, and it's actually irritable bowel syndrome. So it makes it really difficult to manage because they just, you know, these patients feel completely out of control of their own health and completely dependent on somebody else to make them feel better. And it can be a very frustrating process, a very like, I don't want to say ominous, but just like defeating process, especially when they flare again. And, you know, I can't imagine what that feels like, having to try to start things all over again. And like you mentioned, the social aspect, going out, being on a specific diet, not knowing where a bathroom is. If you're in the middle of a flare, it's you can't leave the house. Going on car trips, going in an airplane, you know, I have people who tell me this all the time. It's so hard to live a normal life. And the problem with these autoimmune disorders are they just kind of hit suddenly. So when they do pop up, it's like basically taking the rug out from underneath you, and asking you to try to get yourself back onto some solid ground. It doesn't happen like that. It happens very slowly. So it's very tough. I can only imagine how tough it is.
Well, and I think it's just like a really good reminder to not just us in dentistry, but everybody in healthcare. When we see patients struggling, it's not usually just one factor. Like, right, they're not coming to you and not brushing their teeth just because they don't want to brush their teeth.
Right.
Or they're not following through with your oral health recommendations just because they don't care, right? Like, for me, it's like this is just another burden that some of these people are already struggling. Maybe it's sleep apnea, it's single parenthood, it's depression from other reasons, it's, you know, a chronic, you know, gut issues. There's just so many things, and they probably don't even identify that they are struggling because this is such a constant burden for them. That's their norm. And then when we go, like, we're going to need you to like clean between your teeth more. You've got another cavity. You haven't taken care of that old crown. Like, you're fracturing teeth. Can't you wear your night guard? I think you're going to need to, you know, get a night guard even. There's just so many things that we're just, it's like an added burden to them, even though it matters. And we totally believe in everything we're recommending. It's a lot for somebody who is just trying to survive their day-to-day life.
That's a good point. That's sometimes it is surviving. It's not living. It's surviving for some of these people. And to ask them to like do something what sounds so trivial is like, oh my God, flossing? Really? You want me to floss on top of my nightly enemas that I have to do? Or, you know, I would completely, I completely agree. It would just sounds so daunting just thinking as you were going through. I was like, yeah, oh my God, I'm exhausted hearing that, you know?
Yeah, hearing it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think we talk a lot about motivational interviewing on this podcast and how to engage your patients in a different way and, you know, create some change behavior via change talk and just really getting to know what are their struggles? What are their barriers? Why are they not hearing your oral health recommendations? And when you start asking those open-ended questions and you start looking at that medical history and you start identifying, like, maybe it's just that their dental IQ is low. They don't understand that bleeding gums are not normal, or they don't understand that these cracks in their mouth when they use a certain toothpaste, it could actually be something bigger. Let's talk about that. But we wouldn't even notice, or we would just be like, I don't understand. Just brush your teeth, like use this toothpaste. What's the problem? You know, and just, you know, using open-ended questions and really having a conversation around the why and what the why are the barriers there?
Absolutely. I think that's an amazing point. And I think, you know, for us as well on our side of things, like you had mentioned, addressing oral health as part of this is something that we need to do, just to kind of get that word out there and get the idea of, you know, it's not just about one portion of the disease. It's about the whole picture. And we need to kind of address each piece of that picture, you know, to make you feel well overall. And that's the hard part to you know, fit into a 30-minute time slot sometimes. But the nice part is we see them every year. So it's a good opportunity to continue to reinforce that and readdress that. So maybe they didn't realize that how important their vaccines were the first time or their oral health was the first time, but you always have that opportunity again and again. And I think, you know, if you are persistent from a healthcare standpoint, they kind of get the point that, hey, they really care about me. It's not just trying to push an agenda. It's because they really want me to do well overall and not sit here and slap me on the wrist. I mean, you know, all of this comes out of a place of We want to see you succeed. We want you to get healthy. If I don't have to see you every 3 months, that's a good thing for you. And, you know, and me, of course, because that makes me happy that I, you know, we've done something correct. We've done something right. So, you know, just keep on it and, you know, continue to have the conversation and continue to educate. Again, like I said, Schoolhouse Rock over here, keeping them informed and advocates for themselves is probably the strongest tool you can give one of your patients.
Jennifer, are there any points that we didn't discuss that you think are of value to listeners?
You know, there's the only thing I would like to, I guess, say is, you know, with these patients who are on medications, the biggest risk factors for them can be that they have, you know, side effects to these medications. Some of these medications can cause nausea and vomiting, which, of course, can be a concern, especially with, you know, the enamel stripping that can happen with the consistent vomiting. There can be taste disturbances with certain types of medications, like the immunosuppressants, again, can lead them to having more infections. So you can also see things like thrush. Very rarely do these cause like lymphomas. It would be a rare thing, but sometimes you can have oral cavity lymphomas that can present. And then mouth ulcers can also be a side effect of medication. So just kind of keeping that in mind when seeing these patients, it's not just about their disease process, but also the medications that they're on. And you guys kind of being that, again, another checkpoint for them to talk to people about, you know, the certain things that they see. The last point of medications I'd like to make is that biologics can sometimes reactivate tuberculosis. We always check before starting a biologic medication, but that is more of a public health standpoint. You guys are right there in their face with a regular, I don't know, pre-COVID, I know it was a regular mask. I'm not sure what you guys are doing now, but you know, of course, you want to be with an N95 if you are around somebody with tuberculosis. So it's always important that we as practitioners check and, you know, you guys just have that as a background knowledge, something to just keep in mind.
To think about, well, we do usually put that on our forms and if they have active TB, we are supposed to still be following transmission-based protocols, precautions, which is under standard precautions. But yeah, that's really good to know because we got enough respiratory diseases to worry about these days.
Right? Yikes. And then I guess the only other thing I would say is, do you guys have any, like as a group society, do you have any standpoints that you want us to address with the patients, especially, you know, because we see them almost as often or sometimes more often, depending on their health history. Are there particular things from a GI standpoint that you guys, you know, typically want focused on that we need to do better addressing? Because it goes both ways.
Oh, man. Yeah, it definitely does. And like, gosh, where do I start? And all the things. I think too. Mostly, like, are they going to the dental visits? Do they have a dental home? So many Americans don't have dental insurance.
Great point.
So that is a big issue. They only come or to a dental office when they're in pain. I think making sure that they understand the importance that it's not – when you see your hygienist, it's not just a cleaning. It's actually – all the screening for oral cancer, it's screening for sleep apnea, it's screening for the lesions, and that we have come a long way in our knowledge and understanding that it goes more, it's bigger than brushing and flossing. There's brushing and cleaning between your teeth, there's pH management, and we know that oral diseases are, they're very prevalent in our country, and so it's hard to heal from other inflammatory diseases when your mouth is out of control too.
Absolutely. My capstone project in nursing school was about doing a mobile oral health truck to a Chicago underserved high school.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I love that.
I'm all on board for oral health.
My thesis for my master's was in emergency room, or I'm sorry, in ICUs, and having hygienists be on staff almost like occupational or respiratory therapist, and they would do all the oral health.
That would be great. Like
the brushing, the flossing, the monitoring for abscesses and thrush and all the things, right? I can tell you, wouldn't that be a dream?
I would love to have a hygienist with me to be like, let's look at this together. Is that thrush? Do you think that this is a candida esophagitis in the esophagus? What do you think about that? Ugh. You know, just to have somebody on hand.
Seriously. My mind is going to like, okay, I see the urethema along the gingival margin. I can see calculus there. I can see that there's probably some unhealthy things happening in their mouth. We're going to need to get them. Or just chronic decay, like, are they struggling? And can we do some things like silver diamine fluoride to arrest the decay until they can get their inflammation under control, yeah, until we can manage the diet? Because, I mean, we could just keep filling these things, but if we don't, like you said, get to the root cause,
yeah,
then we're going to be continuing to deal with this. And that's and if they're going to start throwing up more, all these things that are going to, yeah, happen, like, why are we going to place restorations, or can we get ahead of it and do sealants? Yeah. Or something like that. Yeah. There's so many things. What a dream it would be to work.
In a perfect world, it would work that way, right? Right. You know, I did actually read a really interesting note in my readings of the fact that patients with IBD, I want to say it was Crohn's disease maybe, but I might be wrong, tend to have, well, they, IBD in general tend to, number one, undergo more dental procedures than the regular patient, than the average patient. And then number two, tend to have more dental caries in both the incisors or canines. Because that's not a really common space that everybody has, you know, dental caries. So they tend to have more presentation of dental caries in those areas. And I don't know why that is. I just had, like, that was just one of the things I had read. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. That they have kind of the more odd placed dental caries. I don't know. Hmm. Now that gets me thinking. I'm like, oh, I should like look into that. Why do they have all of that?
Same. Well, this was a really lovely conversation. I really appreciate your time and your expertise and being willing to discuss with dental hygienists what's happening with your patients and kind of collaborate in this way. This was fun.
Absolutely. It was a blast for me.
Well, I would love for people to be able to find you if they have any more questions. Where can they do that?
Sure. So I do general GI, as I mentioned before. So I don't just specialize in doing IBD, but I also focus on other things like GERD, IBS, diarrhea, constipation, abdominal pain. So I do a lot of education on general GI, and then kind of a little bit beyond that, you can find me on Instagram under the handle of Gut Gals. That's GUTGALZ. Keeping it fancy there. And then I also have a TikTok, which I think would be kind of considered humor, quote unquote, and general GI knowledge. So there's a little bit of a mix, and you can always ask me questions on those. Just for general information to learn more about certain topics. I always take suggestions and try to answer those as well. I also am you can find me on Twitter and Facebook as well. Although I will say my two primary accounts are the Instagram and the TikTok account. I post fairly regular on those and I look at them pretty regularly. So you can get in contact with me on that.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you so much for your time. We do appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time. It's been great. I really enjoyed this.